This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this music is the Farandole from L'Arlésian Suite No. 2 by Bizet. It's a live recording of a performance by Me Too Orchestra at the Chandler Music Center in Randolph in January 2017. Me Too is the world's only classical music organization created for individuals with mental illnesses and the people who support them. The Me Too orchestras in Burlington and Boston are comprised of musicians who perform in concert, encourage dialogue about mental health issues, and work to erase the stigma surrounding mental illness. And that brings us directly to our conversation. This is Mental Health Week on Vermont Edition, where we are assessing our system of mental health care from many different angles. Today, we're going to address the stigma attached to mental disorders. People who suffer worry about their job security, their physical safety sometimes, discrimination in housing and opportunities, and internalized shame. Sometimes the stigma associated with these conditions is a barrier to receiving care at all. Our guests today say this is a life-or-death situation. I'm joined by State Representative Ann Donahue from Northfield. She's a longtime mental health advocate and the editor of Counterpoint, which is a newsletter put out by the Vermont Psychiatric Survivors Organization. Representative Donahue, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Jane.
I'm also joined by David Blistein. He's the author of David's Inferno, My Journey Through the Dark Woods of Depression. And he lives in Brattleboro. And we talked to you a while back, David, about your book. It's nice to have you back on the program as well.
It's nice to talk to you, Jane, again.
Both of you have been public and open about the struggles you've had with your own mental health. And I'm just curious to hear how you have experienced either fear or shame or discrimination or stereotyping that sometimes goes along with an association that people have towards people with mental illness. Representative Donahue?
Well, I'll tell you, Jane, I first made the decision to talk publicly after I had had a series of hospitalizations in the late 90s, and the state was introducing and first discussing the parity bill. To provide insurance coverage parity, and
with physical illnesses, right? So the idea was you treat mental illness the same as any other physical illness.
Well, or the rest of healthcare,
right.
I rather say physical health is kind of an odd terminology too. It's really about mental health and mental well-being being recognized as a part of the rest of our healthcare, rather than being segmented out. And I realized that unless people saw a face on it, recognized who people are with a mental illness, that it was difficult for them to make that connection, and I made that decision. But it was a difficult thing. And people will say, oh, that's so brave of you to speak out. And I'll answer, That's putting a finger on the problem. The day that nobody thinks it's any braver to talk about your mental wellness than about your broken leg is the day that we'll have overcome stigma. But it is a scary thing. You recognize from other public comments that people will see you differently. They will see you as having a weakness, not being able to get your act together, having something wrong with you in a way that often creates fear. And it's not a rational fear, but it's a fear based on misconceptions. And misconceptions, I think, based a lot on not understanding.
Did you experience that or do you experience that with people who you actually come in contact with? I mean, you mentioned you can see it from the way people respond in comments to others or in sort of our society at large, but have you felt it personally?
Well, much more so earlier on. Now people don't see me first as representing mental illness. They see me as other things. But I still can be present where there are conversations or jokes or really inappropriate use of language or terminology that makes me uncomfortable because I realize they don't even realize they're saying something offensive. I know early on in the legislature there was a time when I needed to go to the hospital for actually it was a fainting episodes I was having suddenly, and The committee chair said, Anne's going to be out this afternoon. She needed to go to the hospital. And another committee member's response was, oh, what kind of hospital?
David, I hear you nodding along in agreement. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, well, so much has to do with language. I was thinking as Anne talked that we never say I am cancer or I am heart disease, but we do say I am depressed. And I think people like Anne and I, both in our own ways, haven't taken that identity on. And so I'm a writer who was living with depression or is living with depression in remission. I'm not that person. I'm not that depressed. I'm not those manifestations. So we don't want to, I once joked a friend at the worst time, I don't want to institutionalize my depression. We don't want to think it's going to be there forever. We don't want to be identified with it. So I certainly understand what she's talking about.
We had a listener, let me just read this and invite people to call in, and then I want to hear what you have to say. But a listener wrote in to say, we as a society need to accept that anyone can become mentally ill. It doesn't just happen to other people. It happens to us. How do you want to be treated? How do you want to see your loved one treated? Anyone can have depression, anxiety, PTSD, even hallucinations. And these experiences can become extremely for anyone. Persons with the label of mental illness will be outcasts of a society that does not want to accept how challenging it is to live with serious mental illness. Thus, stigmatizing of the mentally ill seems to be a socially acceptable prejudice. How sad is that? And I want to invite those of you listening to share your experiences, your questions as we talk about the stigma of mental illness today. You can share your thoughts on our webpage at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Sorry, Representative Donahue, go right ahead.
Well, I was just going to jump in on the language issue because it's interesting. Even that comment you just read, which was from somebody who was so supportive and really understanding that actually these are conditions we all have, but some in more extreme versions. But the term the mentally ill, you know, the cancer-ridden. but another very common term that's coming in more and more use is the term behavioral health. And that term is sort of a return to it's about the scary things you do. It's about your behavior rather than an ordinary part of health, or rather than about being mental health. So we even coin new terms that perpetuate some of those stigmas. And I think about even a lead into this show, there was a reference to about how the state cares for those with mental illness. Why would it be the state? Why aren't we talking about our healthcare system rather than some segmented state function?
You mean like as opposed to all of the other ways that we access healthcare that are not based on state government?
Exactly.
Can we talk a little bit about how internalized some of these stereotypes and some fear is that can actually create a barrier to getting care at all for people who are struggling? Because, you know, one of the questions is if you're worried about your job or if you're worried about how your family and friends might react, you may not even want to go see a doctor. You may not be able to sort of cross that hurdle and get care at all. Anne Donahue, is that something that you see through the literature and through experiences and interactions that you've had?
Oh, well, both, yes. I mean, the literature is very clear that stigma is the single largest barrier to people accessing care. And I know when I first was having symptoms of severe depression, I would never have been willing to go on my own to see somebody about it. I never would have – I would much too afraid of what it would be saying about myself. And it was only because I had friends who sort of backed me into a corner that I ended up going. I'll never forget the first day I was admitted to a hospital and kind of that horror of reflecting on at the time what I saw is what it said about me. How could I be in the psychiatric ward of a hospital? And so that's very prevalent in even how we think about ourselves as people, that if we have challenges emotionally or to our mental health, we do take on some of that blame or responsibility, and how we fear what other people will think as a result. And, you know, everything from entertainment to news reporting to everything in the world around helps perpetuate that message.
We got a note from Alicia who says, my husband was a nurse and suffered from depression and anxiety. He was afraid to seek help in the places he wanted to work. He was hospitalized for a suicide attempt and then released after he found a therapist. They didn't find one for him or do any follow-up. The story goes on with hospitalizations and drugs prescribed and changed without any physician supervision. Ultimately, he did take his life after another prescription shift, and I believe shame was the dominant factor in his suicide. He was treated as if he didn't matter, as if he were being difficult on purpose. My life and my children's lives are forever changed by the stigma around mental health issues and suicide. Thank you for trying to shine a light in that darkness. David, as Alicia points out, this can be a life or death issue, not accessing the care you need.
It's a fatal disease. It's a fatal disease for many people. It's as fatal as cancer. And what's interesting in terms of preconceptions is that when someone says, oh, I have to try a clinical trial for a last-ditch cancer drug, we admire them, and rightly so. They're like pioneers. But when someone says, no, I don't know, I'm going to do electroshock therapy or I'm trying some new medication, it's like, oh, I don't know. So we aren't really ready or willing to give people with severe mental challenges the leeway we give other people in dealing with their own illness.
Did you find any difficulties in getting yourself to the medical care you needed to, as you say, get yourself into remission?
Well, I think one of the reasons that it's sort of seen as a weakness is that everyone deals with their emotional states all the time. We all do. I mean, I dealt with mine with, you know, cigarettes and alcohol for many years, and I dealt with it with exercise and B vitamins and, you know, different things. We all try different things, and we're sort of very proactive in it in a way. And then suddenly there comes a time that Anne's talking about where someone, you know, one time my wife and one time a friend, a second episode said, okay, that's enough. That's enough. It's time to stop. So I think because so many people are able to deal with their emotions or their what goes on in their brains themselves, that when you can't, you think you're doing something wrong or you are ashamed.
You mean you yourself feel that idea that this is
yeah, I should be able
failing.
To do it. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I should be able to do it. If I just worked out more or if I just took more deep breaths or I said more affirmations. There are all kinds of things that people say, well, why don't you do that? In fact, I've said to myself, why don't I do that? But there's a point where it tips over. As Anne well knows, it tips over.
David, what does work for you?
Well, you want my medication profile? that's really easy. That's pretty much what works, and it's worked for a long time, which is rare for people. At the same time, once in a while, I say that if you've had a major depressive episode, it kind of sits over your shoulder. It's always kind of there. And once in a while, it's like, oh, whoa, there it is. And at times like that, I can pretty much now use those other kind of techniques. Now I'm balanced enough. I have a base that's strong enough that I can go work out. I could even do an affirmation if I wanted to. I could get a massage. You know, whatever. I don't panic. But back then, none of those things worked.
And Donahue, we were talking just a moment ago about this barrier to accessing medical care because of shame or fear. But I know that you have also looked into questions about the kinds of medical care that people get when they have been diagnosed with a mental illness, that sometimes that can affect other types of care they're getting. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because this was something that I didn't know much about.
Yeah, there's a term actually for it. It's called diagnostic overshadowing. And it's something subconscious that happens even, you know, among our best physicians, our healthcare system, that if you have that label attached, they might not look for some other underlying health conditions and completely miss them. And I wrote about this recently in Counterpoint and had a very painful letter from a woman who responded, who said her own brother, who dealt with schizophrenia most of his life, and he actually developed a brain tumor. And it went undiagnosed because his symptoms were all chalked up to being part of the mental illness. And he died. So that's an extreme example, but it's not uncommon for other symptoms to be misunderstood as a result of having that label attached that we can explain, you know, these behaviors this stuff that you don't know how to take proper care of yourself, and that must be the cause. It's even the stigma attached to the comment you often hear, oh, he went off his meds.
Mm.
Well, you know, not all medication works for all people. It's wonderful when a medication helps. But there are also a lot of folks with other health conditions who don't necessarily follow prescribed medications because of side effects and so forth. And there's this automatic, if it's mental health, he's responsible for his condition or she's responsible for what happened, because automatically we say, didn't maintain their medication regime.
And then on the other side, you have people that say, you shouldn't be on medications at all. You know, you've never had anyone say to you, gee, I hope you can get off those B vitamins sometimes. But a lot of times people say, gee, I hope you can get off that antidepressant. So there's so many mixed messages in the culture.
How do you respond, David, when people say, boy, I hope you can get off those medicines?
I just laugh. I said there, but for the grace of God, go you. You know, I don't take them seriously at all at this point. I think I'll say one thing. There have been all these studies and people quote these studies about showing that placebos work just as well. And you talk to any therapist, anyone that's dealing with empirical knowledge, and they've seen people just come out of the depths. And I'm sure there are some people who don't need medications. I'm sure there are people that don't need B vitamins. But it's not, as I say, depressives don't have the luxury of fixed opinions. We don't have the luxury of paying attention to statistics or people's opinions. We have to do what helps.
We got a note from a listener who says, I'm the mom of a son with such challenging mental health issues that he's been institutionalized for the last 3 years. While his struggles were obvious to us and his mental health care providers, the poverty of knowledge, judgment, and the lack of compassion we all suffered at the hands of community mental health, child protective services, and the school prevented our son for over 6 years from receiving the intensive level of care that he has always needed. We all suffered. The stigma of mental illness not only harms people who live with those challenges in themselves, it is also devastating to anyone who loves a person with mental illness and attempts to seek care for him. We are seen as equally broken, incompetent, and damaged. Instead of protecting, serving, and supporting us, state agencies humiliate, blame, and traumatize us time and time again. These are difficult stories, difficult experiences to hear, but I think as we talk about this idea of breaking or tearing down the stigmas associated with mental health and mental illness, it's really powerful to hear them. So listeners, if you would like to share your experiences or if you have comments on how to reduce the shame and fear people feel about getting treatment and going public, post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. The best podcasts are spread by word of mouth. Think of your latest obsession. You probably heard about it from a friend or a family member. Well, this month, we're asking you to pay it forward. Recommend a great podcast to someone special in your life and watch the sparks fly. Then tell us what you shared using the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. Oh, and a pro tip. You can use that hashtag to find some really great new shows for yourself, too. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition, and today we are talking about mental illness and the stigma attached to it. If you'd like to share your perspective, post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking today with Brattleboro writer David Blistein. He's the author of David's Inferno, My Journey Through the Dark Woods of Depression, and with state legislator Ann Donahue, a longtime mental health advocate and editor of Counterpoint, the newsletter put out by the Vermont Psychiatric Survivors Organization. And we are hearing from some of you today sharing your own experiences. Let's go to Sharon, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, Sharon. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been struggling with anxiety, depression, and PTSD since it hit me about when I was 42. And I'm almost 63 now. And I've gotten a lot of bad feedback from my family about being on medication, and it really hurts, and I don't know how to deal with it, to tell you the truth. I have one sister that supports me somewhat, but I'm always getting the get off the medication stuff. It's going to kill you. You know, she's very holistic, and I just want to ask if there was any advice that you could share.
Yeah, Sharon. Thank you so much for sharing your story and your questions. David and Ann, I'm sure both of you have suggestions for Sharon on how to deal with this within your family when you don't feel like you're getting support for the medical care that you believe you need that's helping you. David?
Yeah, it's really hard, but you have nothing to be ashamed of. You have nothing to be ashamed of. And it's there. Ignorance, as in the phrase ignoring, as in the meaning ignoring. They're ignoring the realities of mental illness. So if they aren't going to help you, if they're not going to be supportive, I just don't want them to diminish you. You have nothing to be ashamed of. And don't stigmatize yourselves. We say how to get over stigma. Well, for starters, we have to not stigmatize ourselves. And then maybe other people, when they see that we're owning, that we're not going to be affected by their judgments, sometimes that will help a little bit. But you should be proud of the fact you talked to them about it.
But David, that's so hard. I mean, as
it's terribly hard.
You have to sort of doubly advocate for yourself. You have to advocate for what you need. But then the people who you rely on for support and love and understanding, you have to, again, just keep pushing against them. I mean, that's exhausting in and of itself.
Absolutely. And that's why I think that there are... You really have to go to where it helps. You either have to go to friends that it helps. You have to go that will help. You have to go to support groups that will help. You don't need I hate to say waste your time with the relatives, but you don't need to spend time with people who aren't supportive. You have nothing to prove to them. You only have to take care of yourself. But it's very hard. I mean, you're absolutely right. Yeah. It's naive to think that you could just do it.
Yeah, it's hard, and it's the reason that people often feel they can't reach out to support from their family members because they're afraid that they're going to react that way. And I think, I mean, David said it all very well, but the importance of reminding people, gee, you know, regardless of what challenges I have, I need to find and do for myself what helps me. If it happens to be medication, if it happens to be something else, I need to be doing what helps me the most, and I'm the only one who can judge what helps me the most.
Let's hear from Phil, who's calling in from the Northeast Kingdom. Hi, Phil. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi. It's just kind of like a segue to what Ann was talking about, except dealing with other physicians, other disciplines besides psychology or psychiatry. I had not that long ago had to deal with an oncologist and later on an orthopedic surgeon. And everything was fine until... Lo and behold, it's sort of like that famous permanent record that follows you through school, that they see I had a diagnosis of bipolar disorder or I was taking medications, and let's see why you are taking those medications. And I got to the point, now I'm, you know, 60, I said, well, you know, I'm really tired of this, and kind of some of that fatigue turned into, well, some anger, and I started having arguments with these doctors. One case was part of a teaching hospital, so I went over his head to patient relations, and I'm tired of it, you know, and so I've been able to, you know, open up to family more and that, so sometimes, you know, that works out. I know it's really hard, though, because for like 30, 40 years, I just was scared to death of telling anybody.
Well, Phil, thank you for sharing your story with us and for talking about this idea of diagnostic overshadowing that Ann Donahue was telling us about earlier. Let's hear from Robert, who's calling in from Marlboro. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Great. Yeah. I just had more of a statement. You know, for me, I had a nervous breakdown several years ago. I didn't even know a nervous breakdown was a real thing until I had one. I thought it was more of a figure of speech, but I just feel like this stigma is, we are just so far, most people are just so ignorant of what is actually going on inside other people that I think we are so far away from being able to educate people to the point where they'll understand the complexities of these issues. But my personal approach is just, this is just how I've handled it, is that after my nervous breakdown, a lot of things were broken, and I felt some sort of comfort in just being honest and open with other people about what's going on and choosing to educate them from my own experiences. And and that has been helpful, not only for other people, but it also just, by not acting like you're a stigma, has helped to get people to say, oh, you know, this is an everyday normal person just like me, and they're not trying to hide it, they're trying to explain it, and that sort of helped me get through it a little bit. But it's something that took a while, and it's something that's very, very difficult for a lot of people who struggle with these kinds of issues to do so.
Robert, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. And Donahue, I can have a sense that you want to chime in.
I'm sitting here nodding my head, saying he's
me too.
he's saying it so articulately, and it is really hard. It is the one thing that can help make a difference, and yet because the stigma exists, it makes it that much harder to do that. And I think it's huge. It's huge in making a difference.
So, you know, we hear about this a lot in terms of different kinds of struggles that people have, that those who are in a relative position of power, you know, if you don't think you're going to have to worry about your job security, or if you have a family that's supportive, that maybe you have more of an ability to speak out for those who aren't in that position. And Donahue, do you see that this ability to have the power to speak out can work for people who are not necessarily in as much fear as others?
I'm not sure how you get to that point where you can say not as much fear, because I don't think there's any position you're in where there isn't a fear. But yes, if for people who are able to, it is critically important, and I think that's what we are beginning to see. That we see that in some nationally known or public figures who are willing to speak, and I think it clearly helps.
Let's hear from M. in Burlington. Hi, Em. You're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And your guest. I wanted to speak to you about the difficulties that I've encountered around men acknowledging their depression, and how at times, in the example in my own life, my kid's father took his life because of untreated depression. And I'm just wondering what they think about gender and, the stigma that goes along and the challenges, especially for men.
I'm sorry to hear about your experience and your loved one. David Blestein, in your research, have you seen that men have more difficulty reaching out for treatment?
Yeah, it's really sad to keep hearing these stories, but I think of that. It's interesting to hear, because I always think of that as kind of a stereotype, but it turns out to be true, I guess, because there are people that feel it's a sign of weakness. Essentially, the way I like to look at it is, and this might not directly answer her, is that after you had an experience like this, you realize if that could happen in your mind, how could you possibly judge what happens in anyone else's mind? And if that other person is a whether it's a family member that doesn't understand, or a partner who won't get help, you just have to sit there and say, I don't know what's going on in their mind, and I have to be supportive of them and sort of hope I can help them in the right direction. But I didn't have that experience, so maybe Anne can talk to it.
Anne?
Well, I think she's exactly right. We have this macho, tough guy society, and because of the stigma of it being a weakness, I think it does make it much more difficult, and places men at higher risk.
And Donahue, you have worked on legislation over the years in your time in the Vermont legislature to, as you mentioned right at the beginning, to talk about parity. And are there laws in place that you think can help end discrimination, or at least help combat discrimination and stigma attached to mental illness?
Oh, we make progress bit by bit, but I'll tell you, it sort of might be stunning to know right now as we speak, there's a bill in committees being debated about parity for mental health conditions if they are work-related, that whether or not workers' comp should cover a work-related mental health condition that has resulted from that. And that's sort of stunning to me, and says in so many ways how far we have yet to come, that we would still make that distinction.
Ann Donahue is a state legislator from Northfield and a longtime mental health advocate and the editor of Counterpoint. Representative Donahue, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for addressing this.
David Blistein is a Brattleboro writer and the author of David's Inferno, My Journey Through the Dark Woods of Depression. David, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, how to solve the problem of keeping your network of support informed in an era when doctors are bound to strict federal privacy laws and using new technology to make your network work for you. And as we go into a break, here's more music by Me Too Orchestra performing Schubert's On Track Number 1 from Rosamunda. Me Too is trying to break down the stigma of mental illness, which is our topic today on Vermont Edition. Schubert's On Track Number 1 from Rosamunda, performed by Me Too Orchestra. Again, it's an organization of musicians who have mental illness and the people who support them. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. One thing common to many people with mental health conditions is that they can be helped by a strong support network of friends and family. But keeping those folks in the loop can be hard, and if doctors are involved, things can be complicated by a strict federal privacy law known as HIPAA. To address these issues, Dartmouth psychiatry professor Bill Hudenko has created software, including a phone app that allows patients to create online networks of friends, relatives, and doctors and share information among them. It also simplifies the process of legally authorizing that information to be shared with different people. Dr. Bill Hudenko of Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine joins us now to talk about his software and app. It's called Proxy. Dr. Hudenko, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So just so that we are all on the same page, can you just briefly explain HIPAA, what it does, and what the reasoning behind the law is?
So HIPAA was really designed to address a number of different issues in healthcare. It really came out during the Clinton era. And the way it influences us most in terms of healthcare providers is often around how we share information with patients and what happens around privacy. So we have these standards that we have to make sure we're always thinking about what information is available to people and how we make sure that that information is protected and only the right people can see it.
So while HIPAA protects patient privacy, it can make having a support network that knows what's happening with your treatment and maybe can intervene or help. It makes that more complicated because doctors are not necessarily allowed to tell a patient's spouse or a patient's parent, for example, what's happening with their treatment, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So while it's intended to protect people, it often can be restrictive, and that's something that a lot of doctors face every day: is how can we get the right people to help and get the right people available for a patient while still maintaining their privacy.
Well, so this is partly where Proxy comes in, this software and the app that you have created to help keep social networks and medical networks all communicating with one another to the benefit of the patient. How does it work?
Yeah, so what we did was for quite some time, we've realized that it is critical to get the support network, we call the natural support network of the patient involved to create optimal care for someone. And the problem has been the barriers around how we actually accomplish that. And what we decided to do was we realized, since so much of that is critical around the patient, we created this technology where patients can download our app for free. They then identify who's important in their care network. And we really challenge people to think about who is important in my care network, who could really help me. Then they just send out a simple invitation that says this person would like you to be on their support team, and the person is linked in. Now, because these relationships with support members don't necessarily start with a physician, HIPAA doesn't apply, and so we don't have to manage that. But what happens is, if they decide to involve a healthcare professional, they can sign a release that then allows the entire care team to talk together.
And so that medical professional would be sort of in the app too, in that network, and sharing information within the software?
Exactly. So it allows them, it's really an omnibus release of information. So everyone can talk to everybody else. And it's sort of an opt-in or opt-out. And that was the way we solved the problem, because we found that by having a ton of different individual releases for individual people, it made it so complex and so challenging to actually provide real collaborative care.
Can you give me some examples so I can picture what these conversations are like of, you know, what a doctor might say, but also what somebody in my care and support network might say to me?
Absolutely. So one of the things that's really special about Proxy is we realized that oftentimes a care team or a support network doesn't really know how to help. And so a good example would be, let's imagine someone in the center has depression and they are hoping to get support from people around them. But usually those people are unaware of what to do. And I think a lot of people have echoed that on the show today. And so what we do is we create this network, and we offer this technology that we call Proxy Reach. So what Proxy Reach is it's a simple 40-character message, or one of these beautiful greet animations, these greetings that someone can send. And it's so simple that the person just taps it and can send a little greeting that says something like, thinking of you, or hope you're okay. And the idea is we wanted to make the barrier so low for people to be able to communicate that and to send those messages of love and support and care without them having to have expert knowledge on what to do.
When I'm sending that message, though, or somebody sending that message thinking of you, how do you make it so that that feels like a genuine message of support, you know, a what can I do that is meaningful rather than just a, yeah, I can send this and then I don't have to worry about it because I'm supporting my friend or I'm supporting my loved one?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we actually thought long and hard about do we do things like put machine learning in and put AI to kind of automate this process of care for someone? And we intentionally decided that we wanted users to have to actually reach out to someone so that they're actually sending that message of care. And while some of those messages, yes, they're very short, so often what happens with people, like if they're depressed, for example, is people are caring. It's just that they don't know how to help, and they don't know what to say, and they don't know what to do. And so these little snippets, these little messages, we think create this incredible psychological space for someone, this capacity for the person to feel loved and cared for, where they just get these little snippets, and that's all they need very often.
Now, and in fact, you can't even do a longer message, right?
Yeah, and what happens is we also offer Proxy Connect, and Connect is effectively a full messaging suite, and what it becomes available once a clinician is on board, because then the conversation becomes more rich, and you can actually have longer communications, side communications, communications with the patient, really between anyone. So we wanted to have that available, but only in a way that was really helpful.
Dr. Hudenko, we just have a couple of seconds, but is this available now for people who would like to have this kind of connection?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Actually, we are submitting it to the App Store this week. So it should be out, you know, as soon as we get approval in the next couple of weeks. And for people who are interested now, you can go to proxy with an I, P-R-O-X-I, .care.
That's Dr. Bill Hudenko. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, if you're looking for that software and app that he created, it's called Proxy, P-R-O-X-I. We are focusing on mental health issues all this week. Tomorrow on the program, we'll look at children and whether we have adequate services for their mental health needs. We'll also discuss how early intervention and taking a family-oriented approach can affect outcomes. Send your questions or your experiences with children and mental illness to VermontEdition at vpr.net and then listen tomorrow at noon. Throughout this hour, we've been hearing music by Me Too Orchestra, directed by Ronald Brownstein. The Me Too Orchestras in Burlington and Boston are comprised of musicians with mental illnesses and the people who support them, and their concerts and community dialogue work to reduce the stigma of mental illness. We're closing today with a performance of Farandole from L'Arlésienne Suite No. 2 by Bizet. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.